Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Just had a call from my press secretary in London. Apparently it's all over the news.
Hello, welcome to Still Watching, a television podcast from Vanity Fair. I'm Hilary Busis.
I'm Richard Lawson.
And I'm Chris Murphy. And we're here to discuss the fourth episode of season 6, part 1 of the Netflix series The Crown. This one's titled Aftermath.
Bereavement helplines are overwhelmed. Sensible adults are weeping openly in the streets.
Later on, the director of the episode, Christian Schwacho, how's my German, will be stopping...
Sehr gut.
Okay, oh my God, seal of approval. He'll be stopping by to talk with me about how we put together the whole Diana arc over the course of 80 shooting days, which is like making...
That's wild.
That's a long...
A very long movie.
Yeah, that's involved. Yeah. Before we get into any of that, let's do a quick recap. The news makes it back to the royal family that Princess Diana has died in Paris.
Your Majesty, Your Royal Highness... I had a call about 15 minutes ago from the embassy in Paris. It's Diana, Princess of Wales.
Prince Charles goes to collect her body and on the plane ride back has a heart-to-heart with Diana's ghost.
The only thought I've had since the moment I heard is regret.
That will pass.
No, it won't.
The Queen is under scrutiny for being out of step with the nation's grief.
What do people want from me?
Attention. And love.
Love.
And then Diana's back. This time she appears to the Queen.
You finally succeeded in turning me and this house upside down.
That was never my intention.
The Queen breaks her silence to deliver an address and try to comfort the nation.
We have all been trying in our different ways to cope. It is not easy to express a sense of loss, since the initial shock is often succeeded by a mixture of other feelings.
So I just want to say up top that Helen Mirren's brilliant in this episode.
That was Oscar award winning.
James Cromwell as Prince Philip.
Right.
Michael Sheen as Tony Blair.
No one famous really played Charles though in the Crown, right? No, that was some random.
In the Queen. You mean in the Queen?
Excuse me. No, everyone is famous on the Crown in the Queen. See, I'm confusing it. Yeah, as we were talking about in not last week's episode, but the previous episode of this podcast, Peter Morgan has covered this before, this particular thing, though he, of course, is taking a different angle here by putting Mohammed Al-Fayed kind of in second position, like in throughout the whole episode. And we have ghosts.
We do.
We
do not have ghosts, according to the director of this episode,
who I spoke to.
It's more of, you know, it's more of a memory of Diana and Dodi. Those are the spectral presences that we see in, you know, the show's conception of it. Mm-hmm. But in layman's terms, yes, Diana's ghost and Dodi's ghost do make appearances in this episode. Very controversially, these are the scenes that the British press has been, you know, tearing their hair out about for weeks in the lead up to the these are the scenes that led, you know, Prince William's rep to say that, you know, he will be disgusted by this show.
Ghoulish,
or they used a word that,
ghoulish. And I think also the British press has taken the fact that during the scene in the hospital when Charles is identifying Diana's body, you know, he looks down. We don't see anything. Mm-hmm. But Elizabeth Debicki was actually lying on a table during that scene, which is something that the director
said. So, look at. Yeah.
So the British press took that as, you know, we are going to see like Diana's dead body splayed out.
Yeah, that doesn't really happen.
Like
though.
X's over her eyes. Like,
yeah, exactly. Yeah, and so, you know, the famously slow to anger Daily Mail and
the measured. Deliberative,
journalistic. Yes. Yes, they've taken these things and kind of blown them out into this big, like, how dare they disgrace her memory? Whereas, you know, I'm sure that the Daily Mail was on the front lines of shaming Diana for everything she did during the last months of her life, of course. But yeah, so that's sort of the backstory on the controversy that's cropped up around this episode, which I don't think is warranted. I think that the ghost moments are. They're cheesy. I don't think they're crass or, like, in bad taste, really. I just think they're kind of silly.
Go ahead.
No, please. I was going to say if they were less well executed, I could see an argument that they were in poor taste, but they're not very long. Mm-hmm. And they're basically, remember, it's not fiction, but it's a television show, and it's a way to get closure.
Were you saying that Diana's ghost didn't actually appear to Prince Charles on the plane?
Yeah, I guess we'll never know. But I found it to be an effective tool to get into the emotion that existed probably in the aftermath of Diana's death in a way that, while definitely somewhat cheesy, was emotionally effective. And I will say, Dodi, who's played by Khalid Abdallah, and then Elizabeth Debicki, really sold it for me. I thought they did a really wonderful job and didn't make it like, ooh, spooky, scary.
Right. There were no clanking chains.
Yeah.
Like,
Charles!
Oh, get out of my amusement park. Yeah.
What are you thinking?
I think that the one thing I had, when the ghosts appeared, I was like, oh, here we go. And actually, it's not. It's kind of measured. They're short scenes. Mm-hmm. I do wonder, though, like, I understand why they did it, but, like, this show has previously painted Diana as this incredible nuisance to Elizabeth and all this stuff. I don't know that she would have invited in a spectral memory of Diana.
Oh, 100%. You know I mean? Like, Elizabeth hated this woman.
Which makes it more seem like she's haunting Elizabeth. that's her choice, you know?
Yeah.
Because I understand they wanted to put Diana and Elizabeth together because they didn't really have a ton of scenes together overall. Mm-hmm. They had some, but like—
And certainly not this season.
But a bit of punctuation to recenter the show. Basically, Diana's like, I'm gone now. Here's your show back.
And she needed to have a moment. I will say, I found myself getting viscerally angry with the queen this episode. Mm-hmm. Being like, you're so fake. You say you're the mother to the country, and right when the country needs you to step up and be the mother, you're now a grandmother.
Like, I can see you, like, at a charity event, chewing her out, like, in your housewife's dress.
I was so angry. I really was actually upset on behalf of Diana, which is ridiculous. But I think the spectral presence of Diana talking to the queen, we needed that to see the shift in the queen's opinion and her giving Diana the funeral that she deserved. Mm-hmm. So while it felt a little weird and was a little clunky, and I think some of the writing on the show is a little paint by numbers overly clear.
No, when she says, like, you have told us what it means to be British.
Yes.
For all, like, these years.
Okay.
You are an emblem of this country we are in.
Yeah. Ultimately, it worked for me. But you took the words out
of my human
mouth.
Being, but also a symbol.
Yes. What an interesting dichotomy for a television show to explore. I think you definitely are supposed to be mad at Elizabeth. And I think that this show has painted Elizabeth in complex tones over the years. This is a complex moment in her life where she really, frankly, fucked up, you know, not saying anything for however long it was.
It seems so crazy to think back that her, you know, ex-daughter-in-law, but still her ex-daughter-in-law, the mother of her grandchildren, dies, and she just doesn't do anything?
Yeah.
And she just stays in Scotland and doesn't—
goes to church like normal?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was sort of foreshadowed, and it was at episode one or two where she—I think it's episode one where she's like, well, Diana's learning what it's like to be outside.
Right.
Like, you know, and it's like, you're going to stick to those guns, like, through this? Like, it's crazy. And that it did take that long, I understand why there was a movie about it that won Helen Mirren an Oscar. It is a fascinating bit of royals lore, or whatever you want to call it, that, like, they were that Elizabeth herself was caught so flat-footed on this matter and just did not pay attention to Well, I guess, do you think this episode argues that this whole Elizabeth, like, misstep was because she was still not accepting that Diana was more famous than all of them?
No, I think it's more, I mean, I think according to the show, at least, it's just like, this is like private, like, right. Yes, she is
and
not
the
in our family.
And Spencer's requested that it be real.
Exactly. And which is also, you know, it's a softer take. It's right. It's less harsh on her than if she were to say, like, no, like, she knows what she did.
I feel like it's, so yeah. I see that, but I feel that while that is true, what you just said, Hillary, I do think there was definitely an element, and maybe it's 40% that and 60% jealousy. I felt the queen and Charles really sort of hammered this through where it's like, we don't understand why everybody loves her, but everybody loves her, so we should do something big.
They didn't see it as spectacle or exhibitionism. Diana gave people what they needed, even if it was just confirmation that great pain and sadness doesn't discriminate. It comes to those with beauty and privilege too. And they adored her for it.
And the queen rejecting that and being stiff upper lip. And I will say Prince Philip also being like, we do things by the book. And then being this antiquated, you know, over the hill royal couple, not recognizing Diana's power and not wanting to accept Diana's power over the people.
I wish they had teased that out more, though. Like, you get a tiny taste of it when, you know, she's talking to the ghost Diana and she's like, I hope you're happy now. Like, you finally
got what you wanted.
You succeeded. You ruined everything. Like, she doesn't really get that much into it, though. It's just kind of that line.
Yeah. I think that Charles line is fascinating, though, because, like, that to me is one of the most negative portrayals of this family that this show has done, is that these stuffy morons don't understand what was appealing about Lady Di. I mean, come on.
About this, like, beautiful, fun,
young,
like,
gorgeous, like, cool person.
Yeah.
Loving.
And Charles is like, but what, guys, but hey, all of the English public, what about Camilla here? And it's like, you know, like,
she's an ace horsewoman.
Like, exactly. It's just, I think that Diana is, as long, the way she functions narratively in this show, I'm not going to say that this is how exactly she functioned in life, but on this show, she is this incredibly significant pivot point for this institution that they never really fully recovered from. Obviously, they had hope for William, and I think he's popular, and Harry obviously has
fled
committed unforgivable sin by, you know, marrying who he did.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, Diana was it. She broke the wheel, you know, or whatever. And I kind of think irreparably.
Yeah, well, I mean, that is what the queen is about, basically. And I think that the queen kind of hits that harder than the show did.
Yeah. I think that I haven't seen that movie in a long time, but if memory serves me, the queen is a lot flintier and sort of less sentimental, right? It's kind of like a process movie in a way, I think. With this brittle, unyielding, and eventually caving person.
Well, and Tony Blair is kind of playing the role that Prince Charles plays here.
Right. Okay.
Right.
Because
which
it's
makes
Prince
sense.
Charles is, you know, Weep City here, which makes perfect sense, but I do wonder, and I haven't seen the queen, and I wasn't privy to these events, and I'm sure he was absolutely devastated.
Mm-hmm.
But the way that this episode portrayed his absolute abject grief, which I'm sure he felt, it was a little not at odds with their relationship in real life, or their presumed relationship in real life, and all the bad times of him being like, I regret so much, I regret everything, which I'm
sure. But has Ghost Diana flirting with him?
Yeah, they're like flirting
sort
again.
Of strange.
I
loved
confused.
You so much.
Thank you for how you were in the hospital. So raw, broken, and handsome. I'll take that with me.
I think this show has never quite convinced me on whatever dynamic between Charles and Diana they've been trying to sell.
I totally agree.
Yeah. Well, and what's interesting also is Dominic West said in an interview that, like, he did for Netflix pre-strike that, you know, originally when he was, like, doing the scene where he's telling the boys about Diana, like, it's very physical and he's, like, you know, comforting them and hugging them. And then they had to reshoot it because in Harry's memoir, he says that his father never hugged him when he told him.
Just put his hand on his knee. Just put his hand on his knee and said, you're going to be okay.
Oh,
but,
really?
Yeah.
This is an incredible detail.
Incredible. In the TV show, he puts his hand on his shoulder, but they don't hug. But per Harry's account, he did not hug Charles.
Yeah.
Hug him.
But yeah, this Charles seems a lot still more like touchy-feely.
I think sometimes the show and just a sort of public imagination of these people falls short because it's like we all forget these people are fucking space aliens. Like, like a lot of them are anyway. Like, they do not have normal ways of relating to one another. And I understand that this is television, and we needed to have a big cry and a yell in the mountains of Scotland and whatever. But I think, I think the Queen is closer to the truth of, like, no, this was a pretty, like, cold affair. They handled this very mechanically, well, when they started to handle it at all. And I think, you know, this show has been building this to this for, you know, seasons, basically, though. So they had to kind of go bigger than maybe it was true.
Yeah. It worked for me. I will say, I think we talked a lot last episode about Muhammad and how they sort of made him the villain of the story. And not that I think this episode made up for all of that, but I was pleasantly surprised that Muhammad and the actor who plays him, Salim Daw, got a lot of time and space in this episode and got to grieve. And we got to see sort of the denouement, like him reckoning with all of the things that he did to have not, if not caused this, but to have led to this tragic event.
Whatever part he played.
Whatever part that he played. And I, you know, when he was crying over Dodie's body in the morgue. And
interesting they showed his body and not Diana's. I understand why, but like, it's a little bit like,
it's well, a double standard.
Maybe don't.
Don't do either.
Maybe we don't need to see either.
Though he is amazing in that scene. And I think that the sentiment when he's talking to, you know, this apparition or whatever you want to call it, this imagination of his son, and he's like, you were perfect. And it's like only with the horrible hindsight of death is he like, why did I waste all this time wanting him to be something instead of loving who he was? And like, it's a corny sentiment maybe, but it's a true one. And I think that it's really nice after that, the weird kind of earlier episodes of this season that were setting him up to give him that moment of sort of not like rending his clothes guilt, but just like a, shit, you know, I should have been better to you, and humanized him in a way that I was worried they would not.
And it's nice that, you know, Dodie is not forgotten, like that he is not just this, you know, historical also-ran.
And it's nice that they addressed how terrible the royal family was to the Fayyads after this happened. They just cut him out completely, ignored him, sent back the plaque that he sent them. And, I mean, it is... The tragedy of Muhammad is that he still, even after all this, he thought this was an event that would bring him closer to the royal family, that they would be brothers in grief. He said that he would somehow be closer to being a royal or a British, person or a white person or whatever you say. And then, I mean, it's all summed up in the line that he says to Ghost Dodie, why do they hate me? Is it the fate of Arabs always to be hated by the West? And it's just that really sort of sums up his whole... It's his major problem that he is coming to terms with the whole series, basically.
Yeah, and Dodie says, like, you know, forget the West. Like, and because he's being mourned all over the Arab world. And, you know, and I think that Muhammad looking at the newspapers and being like, you'd think one person died.
Know?
And that was very true at the time. And I think it's important that this show, as fudged or uneven as its portraiture might be, at least did make Dodie a palpable, and his father, palpable presences narratively for multiple episodes. It wasn't just like a one-off thing. And I think that that is respectful in a way that pretty much no one was at the time.
For sure. And, you know, and there's also still, like, it's not like Muhammad also, like, just learns his lesson at the end either. He's like, they were engaged. Like, he's still kind of clinging to that delusion, which is, like, maybe sort of, like, the saddest part of it.
But I think, you know, I think that conversation about the West and, you know, what, like, is this the fate of Arabs, or, you know, also does speak to a much bigger sort of matter of identity when it comes to post-colonial England and all that stuff, and one that's still going on.
Very relevant, to this day, in a way that history has a tendency to repeat itself.
It just felt political in a way that I didn't think the show would do, and I appreciate that.
It might not have known that it was doing at the time that it that happened.
Also very possible, So we get slightly more time with the princes in this episode. Still not very much, but I think that the show does have to kind of set them up. We're going to start following them next. You guys think that, how did you feel about those scenes? You know, we see the recreation of the famous, you know, scene of them walking behind the
processional
coffin.
I thought that
William
line.
Running away.
William going to
Oh, right, right. I thought that line about they're not crying for her, they're crying for you. I thought that was sort of like, I don't know if that's really true, but like that's a sort of, a nice idea of something to say to a kid during that moment, I guess, kind of. Mm-hmm. But, like, yeah, I think it's interesting because I don't really know anything about William and Harry's personalities beyond, like, little things I've read. I guess we know more about Harry, but William is such a blank for me that for all I care, they can just invent a personality for this show. I don't care. Yeah. We haven't yet seen that emerge, but, like, they're going to switch actors, I'm assuming.
Yeah,
right?
they have to.
They age them up.
Right, yeah. But I think I'm ready. I mean, I thought it was going to be kind of weird. Like, maybe they should just never be on the show, you know, because they're too present in real life.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I think they've built well toward it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I will say, you know, seeing little Harry crying in the church and then writing the mummy letter and putting that, it was really emotionally effective. And you can see how... And with hindsight and knowing where their relationship is right now, or reportedly how bad their relationship is right now, if you read the tabloids and read the news, it added like another layer of sadness to the whole proceedings. And William, I thought it was also really poignant and kind of like, ooh, like a line that struck me when William's like listening in on Charles talking to the Queen and being like, you know what, he's the future king and he's shy, but he's sort of got to act like a king and step up right now, which is sort of the worst thing you could imagine hearing your father saying the day after your mom dies.
Yeah.
But also, that is a point that Charles is making that it might be fair. So I do think we spent enough time with them in this space where I don't feel like I know them, but I am now interested in them. And I would like to get to know them for the next six episodes.
It does feel like Diana's death hastened something that was always going to happen for William, which is like, at a certain point, kid, your life is not your own.
Yeah.
We'll let you have a childhood, sort of. You still have to do some, you know. But then when Diana dies, it's like, okay, grow up immediately.
Yeah.
And like, you have to like get ready to be, you know, a sort of public figure because you're now in every photograph imaginable.
Yeah, and it's too easy, I guess, to attribute like everything that's ever happened in like their lives to this like foundational tragedy. Yeah. But like you watch and it's just like, wow, this was so yeah, I am curious. As somebody who was not very cognizant of like, you know, the phenomenon that was Diana, did watching this make you feel like you kinda understand it more?
Oh, I mean, the cuts to what I assume were real footage of her funeral with all of the flowers and the scores
just
of thousands
every
of people
packed
to the gills. And again, you hear about this. Like I vaguely remember, you know, parents and people talking about it or referencing it when I was getting older, but I didn't really experience it or live it. And seeing the outpouring of love and affection for this one woman was really moving and really did cement that she was something special and meant something special to the world that could not be contained by the royal family.
Yeah, just people really felt like they knew her.
They knew her and that they loved her and that she cared about them in a way that, and I'm not going to compare it to the Queen's death because there was a big outpouring for that too, but it's just different. It just seemed kind of different than what we recently experienced.
I didn't realize, because I was reading about it after watching this episode, I didn't realize that the term the People's Princess was kind of coined only after she died.
Oh, yeah, that Tony Blair made it up, which is nuts.
Because I hadn't realized that, and I think that's really interesting. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, it's kind of one of those things where, like, I think back to that Mad Men episode with the Kennedy assassination where it's like, I feel really bad for anyone who had a wedding, like, a week after this happened.
Do you remember where you were when you found out?
Yeah, I was in a farmhouse in Rhode Island where I spent a lot of summers as a kid and with my parents. And my mom woke me and my sister up when she heard on the radio that Diana had been in an accident. And then the next morning, she informed us that she had died. And we just had this, like, weird glum breakfast. And, like, my mom was crying.
Yeah.
And, like, I mean, my mom was good friends with her. No, my mom, you know, like, probably had never been to England at that point. And, like, but it just
your
was,
mom, Elton John.
Yeah.
Sure, David Furnish, but okay. but yeah, I just, it was such a thing. And it was, in my memory, it was all anyone could talk about. We weren't back at school yet, but so I didn't have that experience, like 9/11. But it was, I mean, I say 9/11, but kind of facetiously, but it actually was.
No, it did feel that. Like, yeah, no, I was at my friend Julia's birthday party.
Yeah.
Her birthday is on August 28th, and she had a birthday party that weekend. Yeah. And yeah, she turned 10, and like, yeah, we were like, I don't remember if we were awake or if somebody woke us up, but like, it was big enough that it was, then that was all we talked about.
I think she might have been at least top five most famous people I was aware of at that age.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have to imagine.
Like ubiquitous. Like it was like her.
The president.
The president, Oprah, and like two other people maybe.
Yeah.
But like she was pretty enormous.
Like Julia Roberts, yeah.
Right. In a way that I didn't really even know that. Who Charles was. I didn't really know the dynamic of the relationship. I kind of think
I don't think I knew what she was princess of.
Right,
but
no,
you
exactly,
just knew she was princess.
She's just a princess.
She's
a princess.
Yeah, she's Princess Di. She's Lady Di, whatever.
And my mom also obsessed with her.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think women of that generation, it was like, because like, you know, the wedding was on TV and that I think that was a really big deal. And like, you know, Americans woke up really early to watch it. Cut to me having to watch William's wedding for work at like fucking 5 in the morning and being like, tough. What am I doing?
Yeah.
But I just, you know, that's all to say that will never happen with a royal again. I don't think.
Well, will it ever happen with a person again?
I will say something that I think the episode did capture that made me ultimately sad was when they're moving the casket in France and they're still paparazzi ever. There's paparazzi at the site when Muhammad goes to the crash site, and there's paparazzi and people, which is lovely while they're moving the casket. But I was like, gosh, even in death, she can't escape it.
Well, it's like, it's like somebody dies of lung cancer and someone's like handing out like cigarettes.
It felt like that, where it's like, even like, let her rest. But then that.
But then it's also we're making this show.
Yes,
like Peter Morgan's not doing it
exactly.
Either.
But it went from a little bit feeling grotesque at the beginning of the episode, sort of the mobs of people and the cameras and whatnot, to then when you get to the end and you see, you know, the people weeping in the streets outside of Buckingham Palace, it was like, whoa.
Well, it drives home just how absurd and thoughtless it was for the queen not to do anything for so long.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, can you not hear outside? Like, this is, I mean, obviously they were in Scotland and they couldn't hear it, but like, but you know what I mean? Like, metaphorically, like, come on. Like, it's not just this country even, it's the whole world. And like, for us to be so tight-lipped about it looks terrible and is harming the children in a way. And like,
and yeah, you know. I mean, then that's a big, not even undercurrent. Like, that is the subject of the movie, The Queen, which is like, this could topple the monarchy like entirely.
Legitimately, yeah.
And that's not really something that this episode gets into, maybe because it's so much the focus of the queen. But
yeah. Well, they made the worst mistake they could have, which they took their most popular person and totally alienated her and shunned her and
ostracized
planted things
her.
About her in the press. And yeah, and that was like, that was not good. I mean, if you want to be really cynical about it, not good strategy.
Not good PR.
Like they should. And then, and even after she died, where that's, I mean, again, to be really cynical, that's a layup. You say something public, you have a big funeral. Mm-hmm. That's a no-brainer.
It
and
doesn't
it couldn't
seem,
even do that.
Yeah, it doesn't seem difficult to understand why the public might want this.
Yeah.
So I've not seen the Crown. The Queen. Jesus Christ.
If you haven't seen The Crown, you've done a good job.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Never would have guessed.
Does it include the Queen's big monologue where she's standing in front of the windows and she's wearing all black and she gives that speech? I'm assuming that speech must be word for word what she said.
Yeah, that's like, you know, very faithfully.
Very faithfully rendered. How did it play in the Queen versus the Crown? Because Imelda Staunton, you know, she's doing great stiff upper lip acting, and then she has that moment that she's pretty reserved but keeps it together, but then says, you know, gives that speech. And I don't want to be like, it was a little underwhelming, but again, I was already mad at her. And then I was like, wait, you didn't even say Dodie's name. You didn't, you know, to the other people that died, that's like, okay, you didn't say Dodie's name. Are you kidding me? What did it land more in the Queen than the Crown, or am I being too critical?
I don't remember that well, to be honest, but I think Imelda Staunton, as good as an actress as she is doing a sort of like clock in, clock out duty. Like, okay, this is how you play Queen Elizabeth, at least on this show.
Yeah.
And Helen Mirren was doing something a bit more like specific. And, you know.
Did she have like an Oscar scene? Like, what was her scene? What was the scene that like clinched it for her?
There's a phone call scene that really clinched it. I don't really remember more than that.
It's hard to go back and remember
the
details.
Maybe
I
mean, here's the thing. It's not streaming for free right now.
We're absolved.
I am shocked to report that. I really thought that it would be on Netflix. That seems like a no-brainer.
That seems like a missed opportunity.
Again. Yeah.
We should consult. tell people what to do in moments of royal-related crisis.
Still Watching will be back in just a moment. And when we return, a conversation with director of this episode, Christian Schwaho.
Hey, I'm Brian Stelter, host of Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. This week, with the help of Dan Adler and Olivia Nuzzi, we're going inside the media circus swirling around Donald Trump's criminal trial.
people want coverage of Donald Trump. There are sort of shades of 2015, 2016. I found it to be a total break from the reaction to a lot of Trump coverage in the last 2 years.
Join me, Brian Stelter, on Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Well, I guess we should get ready to cue up Elton John's Candle in the Wind. Princess Diana has died, and the world has been plunged into mourning.
As the characters of The Crown deal with their new reality, we track down someone to tell us what was going on behind the scenes.
I got a chance to speak to director Christian Schvaho about putting these real-life events back on our screens. Here's our conversation. You directed episodes 2, 3, and 4. So what conversations did you have going into this batch of episodes with Peter Morgan?
First of all, I directed the divorce of Charles and Diana in season 5. Mm-hmm. And I just loved working with Elizabeth Debicki, who plays Diana, so much. And very early, I think everybody who worked on The Crown realized that this is a very special artistic collaboration between me and Elizabeth. So I was asked to come back for the final season very early. And then Elizabeth and I decided we want to complete Diana's journey together. Because most people don't know that from the moment where Dodi and Diana met until they died, it was only 6 weeks. And it was a great challenge to have 3 episodes who kind of tell the story of their romance and their affection and all the tragedy that came after. And we tried not to recreate every single bit that is recorded, but we tried, especially with Peter, to find an interpretation of the events. And I think we managed pretty well.
Yeah, it's a really powerful batch of episodes. I mean, Elizabeth is really great in them. What was it about her, Diana, that you think you responded to so well and that allowed you guys to work so well together?
I think Diana is probably the most famous woman in the world, even now. For so many people, she's a true hero. And the way Elizabeth approached her is not portraying her as a hero, but as a human being. So there are so many scenes where she didn't care if people would like her or not. And that's what I love about drama, to having, even though these people are so iconic, but why we love to watch them and to follow them is because they're human. And Diana, she had a great heart and she was a beautiful soul, but also she had her flaws and she had those moments of absolute loneliness. And Elizabeth always tried to find all these layers in every scene, and that was why it made it so beautiful to work with her.
So was there any conversation or discussion about showing the crash itself on the series?
There was. But I remember that very, very early, we decided we will never see the crash. We will never see Diana's dead body. Even though on shooting days where I had, there's a scene when Prince Charles comes into the hospital in Paris and sees Diana's dead body. We don't see it. He sees it. But Elizabeth Debicki was there on the day to be a partner for him.
So Dominic West is looking at her.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And responding to her. And in order to get this truthful emotion, I asked Elizabeth to be there. But very, very early, we decided we don't want to exploit these dramatic events. We have to tell the story and we want to tell the story, but in the most respectful way.
Is that also why we don't hear Charles and the Queen learning that Diana has died and him telling that to the princes as well?
Absolutely, because for this episode, there are several moments where people hear the message. And again, we didn't want to exploit these moments. So that's why Peter decided actually very, very early on script stage to mute these moments. Of course, we shot them. I had these dialogues, but the decision was made very, very early in the process that we observed these moments from a distance out of respect for the family, but also, yeah, not to exploit the drama that they all went through.
Yeah, there are a lot of ways in which this episode, I think, kind of gets at the weight of that without us hearing it or, you know, directly seeing it. You know, there's there's a tiny bit of diegetic music at the very beginning of the episode, but after that, there's no soundtrack until kind of the news, until she dies and the family learns, and then the opening credits. Was that also sort of a conscious decision for that reason, a similar reason?
Of course. I mean, we have so many people working on the show, and every decision is a conscious decision. Very often we use music, and we use kind of music with a big scale to give the audience the feeling that they're allowed to feel what they feel. But we don't use music in a way that we manipulate the audience. And especially in this episode, The Aftermath, we know that there's so much emotion, there's so much devastation. We always felt like we don't need a big emotional score to tell the audience what they need to feel, because we trust in the audience. They will get the feelings of the characters, and they will have their own emotional journey.
Was there any one scene in particular that you found most challenging from episode 4?
Actually, the whole episode was really challenging because there's not that much story, and that's not a criticism. There are so many scenes that give space for emotions and the response to Diana's death. The main storyline is the Queen not going to London to speak to the public, but that's not, you know, it's not a big drama. And I had to find a way that the audience doesn't kind of go dry or gets bored after 50 minutes of all that grief, if that makes sense. And that was really, really difficult.
And it's also material that I guess Peter Morgan explored in the movie The Queen, which maybe feels... How would you compare these two examinations of that same material?
So when Peter showed me the script the first time, we had this conversation that the story was already told before, and then I decided not to watch his movie again. So it was a long, long time ago that I saw it. And in between, I directed four other episodes of The Crown. So I decided, and I think Peter too, not to compare it, not to worry if there's any repetition. We made a new episode, and we find a new way of telling the story. So the film was never a reference.
This episode does also have Diana's presence in a way that story didn't. So I'm curious, when you first read the script for episode 4 and, you know, saw the conversation that Diana has with Charles and with the Queen, and that Doty has with his father after their deaths, how did you feel about those scenes? How are you thinking about how to visually represent them?
Yeah, we had many conversations about these scenes. And I totally got Peter's idea that it would be great to have a moment for the characters, but also for the audience, to see Diana again, not as a ghost, but as the memory of these people. So the way we approached it visually was to make these scenes as, I don't know if this is a word, if this is correct English, as unghostly as possible. So as realistic,
more realistic,
absolutely realistic. No, don't play any tricks. Don't add any flavors to make it something bigger than life. Just treat her as a normal character. And yes, filming them, thinking about them, I was worried. But the moment we were filming them, we all felt and said, "This is absolutely right."
Mm-hmm. Can you remember any specific directions you gave to Dominic or Elizabeth or Imelda when you were shooting those sequences?
I remember talking to Imelda about the scene where she meets Diana as her memory. I said to her, don't look at her. Don't look her in the eyes. And when you watch the scene, the queen never looks at Diana. And it feels right.
Why did you think she wouldn't look at her?
Because I felt it's already so strong that the queen allows this memory to take place and to have that conversation with Diana and to listen to her. But looking at her would go too far.
Yeah, I guess she's not as attuned with her emotions, maybe, as Charles is. So they would react differently. And I thought that it was really nice also that the episode makes room for Doty and his father as well. Was that important to, you know, give them the death, the crash? Obviously, there was not just one person who died. And I think that, yeah, this episode gives a nice moment to the other family as well.
I can't judge on Mohammed Al-Fayed. And it's not the point if I like him or if I find him sympathetic or not. But looking back at the material, looking back at the newspapers from then, it really honestly feels like there's one person who died. So
then he's a footnote or something.
Yeah. This is what I loved about the script. And a very, very early, probably the first draft of the script already had this big appearance of Mohammed and gave a lot of space for his grief to show a very, very different side of his character and give a lot of space for the audience to understand that no matter how he treated his son, he loved him and he cared about him. And shooting all these scenes, you know, like the procedure in the mosque, which by the way, was the actual mosque in Regent Park where it happened back then. And shooting the funeral, which happened at night in the dark, whereas everything what happened with Diana was in the spotlight, felt very, very important to us.
So where was production? Where were you in production when Queen Elizabeth died?
The team was in Barcelona. And when the Queen died, it was the day before my first shooting day on season 6. So we were all ready to go. And then the Queen died and we paused for a few days.
Did her death change any of your approach to episodes that you directed?
No. I feel, even though we show the Queen and the Crown always did that in a very ambivalent way, but there's always respect to her. So we all felt there's no need of changing anything.
And do you feel like, you know, that real world event had any impact on when you were shooting the actual funeral scene for Diana? Like there's, you know, that powerful moment with Philip and the princes walking. I'm just curious kind of what the mood was when you were shooting that.
No. I mean, shooting these three episodes was the longest shoot I've ever done in my career.
How long did the three take all together?
80 shooting days.
Oh my gosh. That's longer than a lot of movies. That's wild.
It was 80 days in Barcelona, Mallorca, Paris, London, Scotland. So you can add many, many traveling days. It was a shoot that felt like, oh my God, this is never going to end. But on almost every day, we were followed by media. We were chased by paparazzis. So there was a high pressure on these shooting days. And we had to read these stories in the newspapers, blaming us for not being respectful. And probably that made us be even more respectful because we never wanted to exploit the drama of the royal family. So I wouldn't say that Queen Elizabeth's death changed the way we worked or shot, but it probably it underlined the responsibility that we have for the audience.
Yeah, I mean, that must have felt ironic also to be chased by the paparazzi and excoriated in the press when, you know, that is the subject of a lot of these episodes.
You know, it's their job, and I don't want to go into the, I don't want to blame them, but so many times it felt like this is unreal because they found us everywhere. The actors and I, we try not to care about it, but it's hard. It's hard to ignore it.
I'm curious also about the final shot of episode four, where Queen Elizabeth is praying and there's, you know, no dialogue and she kind of looks over her shoulder. What are you trying to convey with that? I mean, I guess it also comes from the script, not just from your direction, but I'm curious, what do you think that final shot means?
Did you feel like she might be looking for her memory of Diana, but it's not there?
That definitely crossed my mind since we do, you know, see her, you know, remembering Diana earlier.
That's what I felt. That's what I told Imelda. Mm-hmm. And I never asked the actors what they actually thought in a specific moment, but there's an ending of a chapter, but then it's not an ending because Diana is unforgotten. And I think the Queen knows that in this specific moment.
Still watching, we'll be back in just a moment. And when we return, we'll see what 90s artifacts made it into the time capsule this week.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
And finally, this episode was definitely a bit of a downer and, like, very somber, but there were still a lot of 90s elements to it. So, you know, I'll go, Hillary, what 90s thing jumped out at you this episode?
I mean, it's got to be Prince Harry writing his card for Diana on a paperback copy of the first Harry Potter book.
That was a little blink and you missed it. I was like,
out
wait,
in 1997. Like, yeah. The timing, it works.
That is really, that's crazy. Because to me, in my head, I was like, oh, it came out when I was able to read it. Like, mm-hmm. 4 years, three
it
years later.
It just popped into existence when you were ready
for it. Yeah, the minute that I was ready for it. Yeah. But it was 97.
It was, yeah. It was. And could you read it in the year 1997?
Ooh, if I was born in 93, let's say, like, we're going to go, no.
Not quite. No.
not Harry Potter level.
Fair enough.
Well, yeah, no, I wasn't aware of the Harry Potter books until, like, the third one came out, I think. Mm-hmm. But then I read them all and, you know, the rest is history.
Yeah.
But yes, if you were born in the late 80s, then you are... this will strike a chord.
Yeah.
I was babysitting a kid and he had the first book. And I was like, what's this? And his mom was like, oh, it's really good. It's this cute wizard story. And I was like, eh, whatever. And then like 3 years later, my mom weirdly got me all the first three books for Christmas and I devoured them and that was that. So
and that was it.
I was a little late to that. I did appreciate Prince William having the Discman with the fuzzy headphones. Mm. I just think it's a better moping look than is like an earbud.
AirPods? Yeah.
You know, like those are so,
they're not moody.
Like, mm-hmm. They're not moody. Like the headphones are like an accessory. Like,
yeah.
It's like I'm shutting the world out.
Exactly.
I'm
and
so
I want
upset.
You to see that I'm shutting you
sadly,
out.
Sadly, I'm thinking of the meme of Kendall Roy from Succession sitting on the yacht with the headphones on.
Right.
And that is exactly, and William was channeling that.
Yeah.
So for me, you know, everyone's like, oh, you're so young. I was born in the 90s. I was there for most of the 90s. I was born September 1st, 1993.
You're younger than Jurassic Park, but okay.
Yes, but still was there, so.
Not as young as The Lion King.
Not as young as The Lion King. But when I saw Prince Harry playing a Game Boy, I was like, oh my God, I had that. Mm-hmm. I had a Game Boy. I used to play that all over. And, I mean, obviously, the boys pouring themselves into their electronics to distract themselves from the horror that mm-hmm. surrounded them is so great. But I was like, oh my God, wait, like, what is it? Like, I had that. Like, I had a literal Game Boy, so that brought me back to Mario days.
And Game Boys are good for sullen distractions.
Because you can just...
Yeah, it's just, yeah.
Lock
kinda
in.
Angrily poke.
Curl mm-hmm. up in a little ball.
Shut the world down.
Well, that does it for this episode of Still Watching. As ever, you can send us questions, concerns, anything else at stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. We're still looking for Beanie Baby offers. You can find me at Twitter, well, on X and Instagram at Rylaz. I almost said Twitter. R-I-L-A-W-S.
R-I-P Diana, R-I-P Twitter. And you can find me on Instagram and X at Christress.
You can also find me at Hillabuster with two R's.
This has been Still Watching from Vanity Fair. Our producer is Emily Elias, and we had production help from Peyton Hayes. We had technical assistance from Gabe Quiroga and Jake Loomis. Stephen Valentino is our executive producer. Our theme music is by Alexis Quadrado. We'll be back in 2 weeks when part two of The Crown drops. Looking forward to seeing you then.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jessie Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as a specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.